This is a Glassbox Media Podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Blank Podcast, the podcast where we talk to well-known guests about their lives, their careers, and navigating and negotiating those difficult moments along the way. I'm Giles Perry Phillips, your resident host, along with the other resident host, Jimmy Davey.
Hello, Davey.
Yeah, I've changed your name. It's Jimmy Davey.
Do you know that happened to me once? Did I tell you when I went on, I was on Football Focus once at a Palace game. I think it was Football Focus before a game at Selhurst.
Oh, so a big moment of fame.
Big moment of fame, Football Focus. And I did like a live thing with a reporter or something, chatting about the game. And they put my name on the screen as Jim Davey. I got so many messages.
Oh, man.
Oh, Jim Davey.
Yeah. Oh, it's the Mike Wazowski moment, isn't it? You know, where look, we're on the front cover of the magazine and he's got like a barcode over his face.
And then I did a thing for football, BBC London about a few months later, and they spelt my name as Jim. They put Jim Daly this time, but put an E in Daly.
Ah.
And then I think I did something for some Match of the Day or something a year later, and they finally spelled my name right. So third time.
Lucky. Mate, I've had my name spelled pretty much wrong in every article I've ever been in. This is why I haven't got Instagram verification.
But yeah, to be fair, how many letters are in yours?
There's so many.
There's four letters in my last name.
Yeah, I know, mate. I know. Yeah,
they should get it right. Can't get it right. Yeah, never mind.
At least they haven't put Daily.
No, that has happened number of times. You've probably had this where you go to like somewhere to do something, you sign in and they give you a name tag, or they give you like a pass, and their name's always wrong, and their I's and E's all over the place.
Yeah.
Or because I got a slight speech impediment, my J's, but I can't say my J's, so I become Tim or Kim. I just all sorts.
I'd go with that though, man. Like I'd be like,
hi, I'm Kim.
Nice I'm, to meet I'm you. Kim. I'm Kim. I'm Kim Daly.
Kim Davey.
I'm Kim Davey. Ah, or Davey. Yeah, I think that's good. I think it's good to have pseudonyms sometimes.
Kim Davey could be Kim Davey is my alter ego.
I always like the idea of going to like a big function and just pretending I'm completely someone else.
Someone else. Yeah, definitely. What would your name be, and what would you do? What would be your?
Well, I think I went to a big function recently and I thought about doing it, and then, but I thought I'd really embarrass the person I was with. So I didn't do it in the end, but I was planning to like just say different things to different people. So every time I spoke to someone new, it'd be something else. So I was going to say
different name and different occupation.
Yeah. So I was sort of going to, I think one of them was going to think like I was going to be like a sewage dredger
good job. Yeah.
Yeah. And then like an international crime boss.
Crime boss,
yeah.
It's like crime investigator, crime mob boss. Oh yes,
yeah.
Mob
boss. Yeah, I work. Yeah, I work in organized crime.
I organize the crime. That's what I do. I'm the organizer.
Yeah, I think that prison inspector. I thought might be quite a good one. Yeah, I just thought. Yeah,
good idea.
Yeah,
great idea. Yeah, the only then you've got to hope that the people you speak to at the party don't talk to each other.
Well, that would be part of the fun, though, because then they'd be like, have you seen that bloke? Like, he's an international crime boss. And you'd be like, well, he told me he was a...
What, the sewage dredger? Yeah. What, Steve the sewage dredger? Are you sure?
Oh, he didn't tell me his name was Steve. He must be undercover.
You'd add a bit, add a bit of... Yeah, or you drop into a couple of people, you're an undercover...
Yes.
...cop.
You could do a bit of a Dom Jolly, couldn't you, and go up to people and go, the seagull is flying over.
the eagle has landed in the nest.
Yeah.
Oh. Anyway, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. I'm quite cold. I was saying to your fair, I'm sort of we're doing this a couple of hours after the interview, and obviously it's a very cold day. I had to then go and do parent stuff, and then put my daughter to bed and I fell asleep while doing that, which I often do. And you said you used to do that as well. Mm. Now I'm back in the cabin. It's freezing cold. When it was cold earlier, I'm recording anyway. But yes, I'm half awake. I'm feeling a very weird state. But it's very cold. It's so we're actually, this is very rare for us. We're actually releasing this day after recording.
Well, yeah, we're not ahead of the game this week.
So this is the week of the snow. Most people will probably be looking out their window, looking at snow right now. Where we are in Bucks, it's a couple of inches. It's pretty thick, actually. But where you are down on the coast, nothing.
Literally, no. Like everywhere around us, like we're surrounded by snow, but Seaford is impenetrable. Like it's like I've always said it's got its own weather front, but the weather front is like mild and fine.
Does it ever snow?
Yeah, we have had snow. Yeah. It's not like it's never happened. But yeah, it's really weird. It's like with a little piece of gritty salt in the Sussex landscape. You know, there's literally nothing on here. And like New Haven, which is 3 miles up the road, is all white and fluffy. Wow. So yeah, it's funny. It's funny how it's happened.
You're not missing too much.
No.
Snow is like really fun for about 10 minutes and then it's actually quite annoying.
I'm not a big fan, I have to say.
Yeah. I went to make a snowman with my daughter earlier and that was really fun. But again, that was literally 10 minutes and then it was obviously, we were frozen and it was too cold.
I liked you because you shared the images with me and it was great because there was this beautiful snowman with a carrot in his face and the next image was it being absolutely trashed and kicked to death by your daughter.
Yeah, I didn't ask her to do that. I'll tell her to. She just took it on her own accord to kick the... She basically did, if you've been watching the football, she did what Wayne Hennessy did to the Iranian striker.
It was like a kind of WWE move.
Yeah, but the look of glee in her eye while doing it was...
Yeah, I wondered if it was
probably
a
worry.
Yeah, I wondered if it was a review of the quality of the work.
I was quite... Do you know what? Actually, I was quite pleased with the snowman because... weren't out there for long. It was very powdery snow, so that's kind of ideal for like throwing snowballs.
Yeah,
you need to do a little bit as well. But actually, for making a snowman, it was quite difficult because it was it's not sticky enough. So
yeah,
kept, like,
you can't bind actually, it.
Yeah, exactly. And I felt like I was sort of like in the kitchen, and I'm like sort of can't get my like dough together. But like do it. It takes ages to roll. So I was like rolling it to try and get the body. It takes ages.
Yeah.
Those big snowmen you see like in the movies and stuff, must take ages to do. Like, it's a big old task.
Like you say, you need the perfect snow. It's like when you make sandcastles, you need like that. It needs to be a little bit wet, doesn't it? You can't have dry sand.
So consistency.
Yeah, it's getting the right consistency, exactly. Well, talking of good consistency, obviously this podcast, we get lots of great guests on.
Lovely.
And lovely. This week is another fantastic guest. It's Kimberly Burrows. She's a phenomenal artist. And also, you know, she is blind. We have to say that out front. Yeah, she creates incredible artwork in spite of her disability. And we obviously learn all about the difficulties and challenges she's faced over the last few years of adapting to this new life, of since she's come fully blind, and some of the other challenges in her life, but also how she's really submerged in her work and how she's actually turned it into kind of a performance, how she creates her work and using her other senses to enhance her work as well.
She's an absolute inspiration. This is not like any episode we've done before, I don't think, really. And it's very raw at times. And Kimberly is incredibly honest about the journey she's had with losing her sight and the incredible low moments that she's felt along the way. Lots of other things happen in her life. There's multiple sort of traumas almost at the same time. I mean, she's been through so much and so many good things are happening and then traumas happen. And she's sort of, one step forward, two step backwards. And she's been through so much. And then she really talks about how art saved her. Basically, and painting in particular, as you say, phenomenal artist. I mean, she's incredibly talented, and her work is not only are the works really good, but they all come from this place of trauma and this place of realism and rawness. And I just think it's incredible. And she really does go into so much detail about the things she's been through. And it's I almost feel like maybe this episode should maybe come with a bit of a trigger warning because it's just it's so. real and raw. Mm. But I don't really think, you know, Kimberly could tell her story without being that honest, really. So I really, really appreciate her coming on and telling us about the things she's been through and her journey. And yeah, she's just an incredible person, really inspirational. So lovely to talk to, easy to talk to, absolutely brilliant. But with an incredible story and a wonderful journey. And I think all our listeners will feel inspired by the end of this episode. It really is a very special one. And I think we both got quite emotional at times with Kimberly's story. So
absolutely.
What a person.
Yeah, it was. It was a real treat to have her on and hear her story. And like you say, we do talk about some very dark themes. So it's good, if you're obviously going through something yourself, maybe this might not be the episode for you to listen to today.
Yeah, or just be aware. I think that's just be aware.
But yeah, so yeah, we obviously touch on mental health and stuff. So yeah, just be aware of that when you're listening. But an incredibly inspiring story, and it was just a real honour to talk to Kimberly and hear what she's been doing, over the last few years, and how incredible journey that and how it's continuing and how exciting the future looks.
And you can actually as well. So her Instagram is Kimberly Burrows Art, because she talks about putting her art on Instagram, the journey. You can actually almost follow her journey if you scroll down to the bottom of her Instagram and follow the journey a bit through listening to the podcast.
Yeah.
And I always doing that or listening. You can see how the art changes, and you can see, it's amazing, really. And then, more recently talks about playing with textures and stuff, and you can see how some of her art's become more texture based, and it's just like it's you can almost follow the journey while listening. Fantastic person, and a really, really inspiring episode, which I think we should get into.
Yes, absolutely. I agree.
So this is the fantastic, the inspirational Kimberly Burrows on the Blank Podcast. Have you done many podcasts, Kimberly?
I've done two before. There's like a visually impaired podcast called VI Talk. I think that was 9 years ago. And then I did one earlier this year, which I believe is called Hindsight is 2200. So they're quite small ones. And yours is definitely going to be the biggest one I've ever done.
Well, thank you. That makes us feel great. Thank you.
Well, we really appreciate you coming on.
No, thank you for having me.
No, you're very welcome. It's such an inspirational story. Normally with our podcast, we kind of start back at the beginning of people's journeys. That's what we're always interested in, how people get from A to B, as it were. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about growing up? Has art always been a big part of your life?
It has, yes. So for me, My story is very intertwined with being in hospital. So I was born as a premature baby with congenital cataracts, and they were overlooked until I was four. I started to have operations and procedures at Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital from when I was four until I was 16. And I think just very instinctively, I just found refuge and a safe space in the art materials. And that's how I don't think I really realized it, but I was using it as an art therapy almost, because I didn't really know how to communicate how scared I was and the things that I was going through. I didn't know why I was having these operations and why I had to kind of uproot myself, why I was away from school and my friends, and why I had to do these things every few months. So I would kind of experiment and get to know drawing and painting. So art is a very big part of my life. It's a very big part of my childhood. Every birthday, every Christmas, I would get kind of the big things at the time. I remember very clearly getting blush art. I don't remember if you remember that from the 90s. Like, oh, that stands out to me.
No.
So Kimberly, every episode, Jim ends up Googling and opening lots of tabs, I think. So
about 20 tabs open every episode.
We're only 2.5 minutes in and the first one has been opened.
First tab is opened. Is that a new sort of milestone 2 minutes in?
I think that is the earliest one ever. Yeah. So
blush art.
Okay. So
wow.
Blush art. Yeah, it's the big thing of the 90s for girls.
I sort of do. Well, I worked in a toy shop, so I do quite vaguely remember blush art. Okay, it used to be in a similar section to like the kind of painting by numbers and stuff, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I loved those too. Yes.
Yeah. Are you having any joy, Jim? Are you finding anything?
I've just seen some really nice pictures. People have made some really lovely artwork. But I'm still not quite sure what with.
So, Kimberly, for those who don't know, are you able to explain blush art a little bit?
Of course, yeah, absolutely. I'm so sorry that I didn't.
No, don't be silly. Don't be silly. That's fine.
It's my fault. I jumped in two-footed. Is what I.
Oh no, no, please don't apologise. So, blush art basically, you were given like a lovely coloured box, and on the inside, I believe it was an easel with stencils, and it was blushes, and it was like powder. And stamps and jewels. And so you had kind of like pre-laser cut stencils of like pretty ladies and flowers and things. And then you had like the coloured blushes where you just powdered it on and then stuck jewels to it. And that was kind of the artwork that you made. And then you could like present that to friends. You could make cards and put it on your fridge and everything. But that was basically what blush art was. It was a very 90s thing. It was lovely though. I have very fond memories of it.
Giles, we talk about school quite a lot in this podcast, don't we? It comes up quite a lot. I'm just wondering, what were languages like for you at school? Did you do languages? How did you find them?
I always found learning languages really challenging. And yeah, I didn't take languages in GCSE. It was just too beyond me.
Yeah, I did do GCSE. I did French in GCSE. You'll be delighted to know. Well, mate, you'll be delighted to know. I got an A.
Nice.
Or as they say in French, an A, which is probably one of the reasons I passed. But then I did it to A level. Because I thought, well, I'm good at this, and I got an E. Wow. It was the jump up was so difficult, and I never really took it on from then. I sort of left it, which is a bit sad, really, isn't it?
It is really, and it's something I've always wanted to get back into.
Well, you'll be delighted to know that thanks to Babbel, there's an addictively fun and easy way to learn a new language. Whether you're traveling abroad, connecting in a deeper way with family, or just have some free time, Babbel teaches bite-sized languages that you'll actually use in the real world. Doesn't that sound good?
It sounds amazing. I want to learn more about Babbel.
Well, Babbel makes learning a language quick and easy because it focuses on natural conversation. That makes sense.
Of course. It's always the best way to learn by just chatting to people. It's also got 15-minute lessons, and they are designed to be the most efficient and effective way to learn a new language.
Babbel's lessons are created by over 150 language experts, aka real people. So you learn how to have a real world conversations, things that you'd actually use, not just meaningless phrases like le cat, le chat est sous la table. When have you ever gone abroad and said the cat is under the table, Giles?
Never. What's brilliant also, Jim, is Babbel's interactive lessons aren't like just talking to a robot. Yeah. They're voiced by native speakers using a modern conversation based method. So in no time, you'll be speaking confidently about real topics like cats under tables.
Or what was the other one? Ue, la bibliothèque. I need to know where the library is. Every city I go to in France or French-speaking world, I have to find the library. Babbel's teaching methods have been scientifically proven to be effective across multiple studies. There you go.
Yeah, and also, I mean, we've obviously been speaking a lot of French, but they do 14 different languages. Oh. So it includes Spanish, French, Italian, Germany, and loads more.
Fantastic. What a choice. Plus, Babbel's speech recognition technology helps you improve your pronunciation and accent. And that is very helpful when you're abroad.
Yeah, it's good to go. I mean, my bonjours aren't too good.
that was okay.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to lie. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. In addition to lessons, you can access podcasts, games, videos, or even join live classes with a language teacher.
Fantastic. So many options. So start your new language learning journey with Babbel today.
Right now, Babbel is offering our listeners 3 months free with a purchase of a 3 month subscription with the promo code blank. That's BLANK. What is that, Jim?
Blank. BLANK. That's a great deal. That's a great deal. So go to babbel.com/podcast22 and then use the promo code blank for an extra 3 months free.
That's Babbel, BABBEL.com/podcast22, promo code blank, BLANK.
Babbel, language learning that works. I see now I'm getting now in my head, I'm getting an image of Banksy starting out in blush art stencils. And then that's what propelled him to stardom.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I think it starts with something, doesn't it? And for me, it was that. I remember that distinct, very kind of perfumey smell of the powder. Equally, I kind of had like the plasticine kind of stuff where you would get that in like a set. I think it was I don't remember what the brand was now, but you got some kind of like I don't even want to guess, but yeah, I'd get kind of like some plasticine stuff and like another thing where you get like a pottery wheel and the stuff would never work. I just get these kind of kicks too.
It's so funny because like I say, late 90s I was working in a toy shop and things like that that was the thing we always after Christmas, that the returns would be a lot of those kind of things. You know, like the things that people were bringing back either because they didn't want them, you know, because I don't know, this is a mess, or they didn't quite work as they were kind of advertised. Yeah, it's amazing. And Painting by Numbers, I was really into Painting by Numbers as well. I used to love the Painting by Numbers stuff. They were great. And that is a great in, I think, for art. Like, I think if you're not very confident, those things can really help, I think, along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no kind of, I think the art world, there's always like this kind of ivory tower, isn't there? There's a lot of like elitism around it. And there is like a hard kind of, there's a hard avenue of how do you get in. There's no pressure with Painting by Numbers. You kind of do it at your own pace. And then, you know, at the end, you do have this very beautiful piece of art. You take your own time. The nice thing about it too is it's like a nice therapy tool as well, it relaxes you and it's releasing all of this serotonin, and you've got this item at the end where you can feel very proud of yourself. And I think there is something very nice to say about the Painted by Numbers. They actually did work.
Yeah.
And like the paints themselves weren't really great, but it actually, and the brushes were even worse.
Oh, the brushes were terrible.
They were dreadful, weren't they? You could stick those through like a needle, like they were dreadful. But those did actually work, so you know.
So initially, was it paints and crafts and stuff that was like at the hospitals then for kids that were going through stuff?
Yeah. There was like little trolleys of things. I don't think they were intentionally there to kind of, you know, you're having an operation, here's some things. I think it was just. With kind of Great Ormond Street being the way that it is, which is one of the best children's hospitals in the world, there's lots of play areas, there's lots of toys. There was just this little section where there was kind of arts and crafts, and that's just naturally what I was driven to. It's the same as my first day of primary school. I was driven towards the easel, not necessarily any of the other toys. There was lots of other things going on. It was just kind of the easel and the plasticine and things that I was drawn to. I was more drawn to being creative rather than being social and kind of doing other stuff. I kind of wanted to explore parts of myself rather than, kind of playing and play fighting and doing all other things. I just, you know, I wanted to be with myself and kind of unpick parts of my own character and, you know, sit with myself. And I think that's quite a quite an honest thing to say, but you know.
I wasn't a play fighter either, Kim.
No, my brother was thing. I think that's why. Yeah. He was a big wrestler, so I did have that part of my childhood too.
I think you're right about the set. I mean, for anyone going through what you've gone through, it would have been stressful. But I think being that young, it obviously must have been incredibly scary. And as you said, you don't really know why you're going back for these things and why you're going back to hospital for all these checkups and operations and stuff. But to have this outlet, you know, and I think art is a wonderful outlet anyway. for everybody, but I guess at that age as well, it's we talk on this pod quite a lot sometimes, are like things you were meant to do find you in a way. Yes. And I'm getting the same kind of vibe with this, that the art sort of found you, like exactly when you needed it.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think you've picked up on quite a lot of things, like I don't really know how much to say, but it's very as a child, it's very subconsciously like, you know, I miss my family and I miss my friends. Yeah. And in some ways I miss school. Like you have that routine and, you know, you wake up at sort of 8 o'clock and you start school at 9 and you miss that. And it's like, I'm not there and I'm missing maths strangely. Yeah. Why am I not there? And there is that sense of life's going on without you. And everyone's sort of getting on with their life, and you don't quite register that and understand that as a 4, 5, 6 year old, but you do pick up on it, that kind of that life's going on and you're not there, and so you do feel very lost, and there is that sense of you're missing out on stuff. And that did continue throughout my life. I did feel that way, that, you know, stuff is going on and I'm not there, and that continued throughout childhood and throughout being a teen, and then obviously being visually impaired and now blind, you do have that sense of stuff has happened without me. It still continues without me, and you have that sort of I'm an outsider all the time, and that's where art steps in and kind of fills those gaps. And you do sort of learn things about yourself through using the materials. And like you very rightly said, like it does find you. It was meant to happen in a way, in a very poetic kind of way.
Yeah.
No, I was just reflecting on that and just can't kind of comprehend in a way all the stuff that you went through and for such a long period of time. I mean, I think you said from the age of 4 to the age of 16, you were going through that, and how challenging that must have been for not only for you but for your family as well. Would that be fair to say?
It is, yeah. We had to sort of really figure out what to do. I think my mum especially, she was going through two things at that time. It wasn't just my diagnosis of, because when she had me and then as I was growing up and realizing like my daughter can't see properly, she's walking into everything, and what do I do? Like, you know, she went to my doctor, who just was very dismissive of her, and she was a young mother, and she was like, what do I do now? Do I pay to see a specialist, which is what she did? And they then kind of mentioned Great Ormond Street. She kind of had to do everything herself, but at the same time her mother, my nana, had a big stroke. So she was grappling that, and back in the 90s, like, we didn't have what we do now, and so my nana was severely disabled. So she dealt with two very big things back then, which is sort of me being visually impaired and then my nana having this, you know, huge disability, and having to be her caregiver too. So she was being a full-time caregiver. So that was like profoundly impactful to my mum, and in a way, I now understand what she was going through. There's no way that I could have done sort of 10 years ago. Like, I would never have really understood the scope of that. But I do now, unfortunately, because my mum has now had a stroke too. So I absolutely understand what she went through, all those range of emotions. So for my mum, it must have been so difficult, so isolating. Like, she didn't have much of a social life. She didn't have a working life that she, you know, that was denied to her because she was always looking after her parents and she was always looking after me. My dad too, in the early days, like, they, you know, they had to wake up in the middle of the night. We all had to get ready and then drive from Manchester to London so that we could be there for 9 o'clock. Yeah, because we did, you know, the trains were very expensive for us. We come from a very working class background. And as we got a little bit older, then we could kind of save for the train journeys. But back then in the early sort of 90s, like, we certainly couldn't afford the trains. It was very big kind of upheaval for everybody. And very big to kind of understand, you know, Kim is visually impaired and can't see how we thought. And Kim is blind in her right eye. Okay, Kim has cataracts, now needs them removing. Okay, Kim needs her natural islands is removing and intraocular ones putting in, and as things kind of kept happening, and okay, now she has a limited scope of vision in just one eye, and then we all had to process that and grieve that, and then you get used to it, and life goes on, and then yeah, now I am where I am now, which is sort of 20, how many years later is it now? It was 25 years later. Mm-hmm. My retina's detached, and that was a very lonely. I went through that on my own, pretty much. Yes, it is. But before then, I witnessed my mum have a stroke in front of me. This is going on like kind of further down the timeline now. I don't know if you kind of want to continue into the childhood. Yeah. Later in my life, I then kind of witnessed my mum have a stroke in front of me. And then 6 months later, I lost my sight. So it's been a very difficult life.
Oh, my word. I'm so sorry. That's so much. That's so full on in a short space of time.
It is, absolutely. But art has kind of always been there. And yeah, just right from the beginning, it's always just been that thread running throughout to kind of be that therapy tool.
Yeah, that's that sort of constant in your life that's been there, and life has clearly chucked so many curveballs and things at you, and art being there is the constant. But I just want to pick up on something you said quickly then, when you're talking about the you and your parents coming to terms with what was happening to you, about sort of grieving that process, and I guess grieving your sight loss. Like, I think that's a really important word, I think, because it is, isn't it? I guess it's a process of grief for you and for your family that you're going through this hugely traumatic thing.
It is, yeah, it is definitely. It is a huge shock. It is a grieving process, and you go. It's not a linear process either. I guess you go through all of them. Not for me as the one in the center of it. I didn't understand what was going on. I'm the one that it was happening to, but I'm also the one that was receiving kind of the teddy bears and the praise, and you're being very good and very well behaved. But I'm also just didn't have the capacity to understand what was going on. But I think for everyone else, are the ones who were the kind of very shocked and upset, but would keep it quite hidden from me too, because, you know, I just couldn't understand at that age. But for them, I think definitely they would have been very sort of going through those grieving stages of, gosh, like, you know, we didn't know any of this was happening. And because they weren't told when I was born that I had cataracts, they just were not told at all.
So how are they to know? Because I think as parents, you're constantly guilty. You're constantly feeling like...
Yes,
guilty about something. Yeah, exactly. And so I imagine that would have been a big...
And that does start on day dot, you know, that's as soon as you're handed this little thing, and then it's like, yeah, here you go. And yeah, and it's constant, unfortunately.
It is, yeah, definitely.
So, Kimberly, tell us a bit about your kind of art journey, like with regards to where you've gone from. Because I think, am I right in thinking that some time ago you were doing more illustration, and obviously you've moved more to things. So yeah, tell us a bit about your journey with your art.
Like I say, from all throughout school, the fascination was always there. I would always take it as my subject. I would always be sketching and drawing in my free time. It was always my hobby, and would always be pinning things to the fridge, like, this is my latest thing, this is the thing that I, you know, want to show my mum and have around the house. And I took it for my subject at GCSE and got an A star. And then I started to do college, but was really struggling for a number of reasons, and there just wasn't the support in place that there is now. There isn't the technology that there is in place. There isn't the understanding for someone with visual impairment or someone who is blind. And I was just really like having a hard time. I was also being teased by my peers. I don't think any of them would be listening in, but if they are, like, thanks so much for making my life hard.
That's horrendous. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, they weren't. it's yeah. okay. They weren't very nice to me, so I just eventually dropped out. So I was just having a really hard time at 16. And I kind of fell back into loving children's books and kind of surrounding myself with things that I loved as a child, like finding comfort in children's books. And I especially loved, like, one of my favorites was Paddington Bear.
Yeah.
And yeah, Paddington's great. And so I started to draw and sketch a lot of Paddington Bear again for about a year. And then found he had set up the Facebook page. So I had gone on the Facebook page and shared some of my some drawings on there. And like the page had liked it, and I was like, "Oh wow, okay, thanks, that's nice." and then the page messaged me and just said, like, "You know, we really like your drawings. I just want to let you know that I'm the daughter of the author." And I was like, "Oh my goodness, wow. Yeah, thank you so much for liking my drawings. Like, I'm such a huge fan." So then we exchanged, you know, some messages. And then she very kindly gave me her father's details so I could start writing to him. So I became pen pals with Michael Bond, the author of Paddington Bear.
And fantastic. That's so cool.
It is. So I was his pen pal for quite some time and had gifted him some of my drawings. And then in 2012, I was invited to his home in London just before the Olympics. And that was probably one of the, if not the best day of my life, I would say. Me and my mum me and my mum were invited up and we went to Hamleys. They have like a massive Paddington display, and so I bought some Paddingtons and bought some gifts up for Michael. And sat in his garden. We had afternoon tea. He brought his guinea pigs out. He has another children's book series called Olga de Polga, who are named after his guinea pigs. We just had a wonderful time. He signed some of my books and he gave me some really wonderful advice. And he was very kind to me about my illustrations and just said, you know, you're a wonderful illustrator. Just never give up. If you love something, like, push it as far as you can go. And I've always kept that with me. I've always retained that phrase and that thinking, like, if you love something, like, push it as far as you can go. I've just always kept that day and my interactions with him very close to me. That kind of spurred me to think, right, what do I want to do with my life? Because I'm just sort of here. I'm very anxious. I've lost a little bit more of my sight. And I do want to be an illustrator, but I'm not quite sure how to go about doing this. I'm very inspired by Paddington, and I'm inspired by my meeting with the author. What are my next steps? I'd like to go back to college because I feel like that was an opportunity that was taken away from me a little bit. So I then signed up to be a guide dog owner, and that took a little bit of patience. It's quite a lengthy process.
Is it? Now, that's interesting. So what makes it so lengthy? Is that because you've got to find the right animal? How does that work, that process, if you don't mind me asking?
No, I don't mind. There's quite a few reasons for it, to be honest. The waiting lists are very long. There's a lot of people waiting for a guide dog, but you also have to wait for the dogs to be trained for them to be trained successfully too. There's lots that just don't really make it through for various reasons. Okay. And once they do, sometimes if there is a dog that is matched, they might not be suitable to you. So there's quite a process to it. It can take sort of 17 months to 2 years. It's a wait, but once you've been matched, it's incredibly worth it. Mm. And I've been with Tammy, who is my guide dog, for 8 years now. This month we've been together for 8 years. This is her final 6 months of working, and then I'll be back on the waiting list again.
Right, okay.
At that point I was I'd just kind of done my application and just been matched to Tammy, and then was like, right, I've got a guide dog now. I'm starting to be independent for myself for the first time. And I'd like to go back to college. And I went to an open day on my own. I went on the train to Leeds. I went to Leeds College of Art, as it was called then. And it was the Access course, which was for older students, for mature students, I should call us. And it was wonderful, like how it all sounded, how it was presented. I really loved the tutor, Adam. I was instantly drawn to him. He sounded like such a wonderful guy. At the end, he even told me that he had two visually impaired daughters himself. And I was just like, right, that's it. I definitely want to apply now.
Funny, isn't it? Sometimes we have these serendipity moments. We meet people that come into our lives. A bit like we were talking earlier about the art found you. Like you meet people, people come into your life.
You're just instantly drawn to them.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's really fantastic. And obviously then, you know, you've got that level of compassion and empathy for one another.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely. And that's it. I just signed up and registered and I did my interview and I wanted to do the level two at first, but he said no, I want you to do level three, and so I was enrolled onto the course, and that I would say that was my best year of education. I really loved it. Loved being with people from all different kinds of disciplines, but I came from the illustration lens, and throughout that year that was when I kind of really came into it, doing storyboards and kind of crafting children's books for the first time. And I felt like I was a proper illustrator, and I really loved it. And I kind of had my ideas and was fulfilling these modules and then applied to do illustration at Leeds Arts University. And that was it then. I was going to university. I felt fantastic. And again, like my first year at university was incredible. I loved my tutors, Matt and Jamie. They were wonderful, really supportive of me and the work I was doing. And I had some really great ideas of some children's books that I wanted to do. So much so that like one of the ideas that I had was definitely going to be like my first children's book that I wanted. I don't really know how much to say, but I think it was a blog that I had at the time when I was blogging about being visually impaired and kind of being a visually impaired student. It was this ITV's This Time Next Year had reached out to me, and they said, you know, would you like to come onto the program? And it's Davina McCall that presents it, and you know, you could come on and we could kind of, you do your video diaries, and we could have it so that you have your children's book, and then this time next year you could be releasing your children's book. And I was like, oh my gosh, like my dreams are coming true. Like, yes, absolutely, please. Like I would love to. And so we did that, and we got all signed up to do that. And I went on the show to do my initial filming, and I got to meet Davina and sit on the couch and talk about what it is that I want to do this time next year. And so we did that. And then after my first year of degree, throughout that year too, I was fundraising to go to Uganda with a charity called East African Playgrounds. I've always been quite charitable too. I come from quite a charitable background. I've always done things with sight loss charities through kind of guide dogs, through the RNIB, through Henshaw Society for Blind People. I've always been quite, I've always liked to do fundraising, and I've liked to raise money and do various activities. So for this one, I would be out in Uganda for a month, and I'd be doing various activities with the children at a school in Kasambira, but equally helping to build a playground, essentially. I'd be doing all the grafting and the digging of holes and constructing a playground with a group of other students from the north of England, and I'd be helping to paint it too. That was kind of the angle that I was coming in. I'd be looking forward to kind of painting it and kind of doing all these bits and bobs around the playground and doing art sessions with the children too. Ultimately at the end of kind of 2017, my mental health was very bad when I came back from Uganda, like coming back from something like that. you know, coming back from, you know, this very big communal atmosphere where, you know, it's very hard to go back to university in your second year when you've experienced something like that, I think. When you've had this fantastic summer and you've lived in this group setting where everyone's worked together as a unit, and you're back at uni where people ultimately just don't really care about you that much. I know you're there to kind of work, but I was kind of the older person with a guide dog, and people didn't really care about me, and it was quite hard, and my mental health was suffering a little bit, and I just needed to take some time out, which I did, just to kind of, I just needed some time for myself, really. And then that's when my mum had a stroke. Well, first of all, my dad left. Then my mum had a stroke in front of me in the Trafford Centre. So that was very public. Wow. And so then I had to be like, I can't do this time next year because I can't keep up with the video diaries that we have to do because I'm now a full-time caregiver. So that was very upsetting too. Not only was I grieving for my mom, and that's again the grief is a big part of my life and my narrative. I was then grieving for this opportunity because, you know, things were happening there that were ticking over with that the opportunity with this time next year. You know, Walker Books were very interested in one of my stories that I had. And we did have the beginnings of a children's book contract, and so we did do the filming for that Christmas, and you know, that was becoming a very real reality, but I just couldn't keep up with the video diaries for it to be a reality. I think Walker Books were still interested, but I just and that was still kind of happening, so that was still kind of there, but the opportunity with this time next year was not happening anymore, so that was quite upsetting. But in my mind, I was like, I need to look after my mom. That's kind of my first and foremost thing now. That's what matters. And that was very sad. And then I had to grow up very quickly because I still felt very sort of like a fish out of water. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to care for somebody else. I don't know how to sort of look after a house. Like, I have experience with living on my own, but as a disabled person, I feel like I'm a little bit sort of, my experiences don't match up with someone who is sighted. So I had to learn very quickly how to operate, you know, looking after my mom and looking after two animals and the house. And then, you know, later that year, I then lost my sight. So then I lost that opportunity to do the children's book. And then, you know, it was kind of trauma after trauma because that summer I had made plans to go back to university. So everything was in place to go back to uni. So a week later, I was due to go back to uni to start my second year again. And it's like, well, how do I do that now? Because I'm having emergency surgeries. And here's my student accommodation telling me that I need to move in. And it's like, well, you're going to have to wait. I'm not there. I'm in Manchester Eye Hospital at the moment. I'm sorry. And they weren't very forgiving. I tried to get out of that contract and then just try and start the year again. And you know what student accommodations are like. You absolutely cannot. So I'm like, we're going to have to do this year. I'm going to have to do this. I'd had two emergency surgeries, and then there I was dropped straight into my second year of uni, and just I had no idea what I was doing. I just am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yeah, you are.
Yeah.
Okay. I just absolutely bullshitted my way through that year. I did not know what I was doing. And then we were doing an animation module, and I was like, wow, that's fantastic. And then the retina detached in my other eye.
My word.
Yeah. And so I had to have operations again. So I had four operations that year. So it got to May, and just that whole academic year was just such a mess because I just wasn't even there, and I had to just retake that year again. thankfully, the animation module had got written out, I think, because of me. But by the time I got round to it again, it was just a lot kinder. The second time around, it was an animated GIF, which was a lot
okay,
better.
Yeah, it's a bit easier.
It was so much easier. And I could have assistance with that, thank God. But yeah, oh my God, it was not a great time. By the time I did my second year, I did so badly. I just got thirds in everything and I just became so jaded. I was just like, I don't really care. And we were going through the pandemic too by that point, but I just didn't really care anymore.
Word, of course, yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I guess at that point, you're just trying to get through, aren't you? And
exactly, you're just trying to survive.
Yeah. Kimberly, it sounds like you've been through such a lot of challenges in the last few years, and thank you for being so honest and candid with us about it.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
And I guess the kind of constant throughout this obviously has been your artwork and maybe turning to that. And would it be fair to say that obviously with the illustration stuff, that was also one of those challenges, because you had to kind of grieve the fact that you might not be able to do this book. But was art in general still there as a constant for you that you could turn to in those darker moments?
It was, especially in the pandemic, and when my retinas had detached, I was like, I don't know how to return to illustration, really. It's a very painful place for me because of the loss of this children's book contract.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it hasn't explicitly been said that it's lost. It's just that I don't know how to tell them what's happened to me. Nothing has ever officially been said. It's just that I've never emailed them back. I don't know how to ever approach them and tell them. It's just sort of there somewhere in the ether. I just have never been able to approach them. And equally kind of with all of my grades going really bad, like I did so badly in my second year, I got third, like it was just passes for everything. I was like, I feel like I'm living in a nightmare, because I was such a high achiever in my first year. I was a student governor, I was a student rep, I was a student ambassador, I was Hermione Granger, like I was getting first in everything. I was living my best life in my first year in illustration, and then I was off in Uganda and doing like amazing things and painting this playground, and then just really just doing so badly. But of course, how could I do a good job when I couldn't even see what I was doing? So I was really like putting such pressure on myself. I was just doing cut shapes and I kind of doing things about chance and kind of how shapes interact. It was such shit, honestly. It was bad. Just we're not even going to go there as to what it was. It was dreadful. It's not even worth it. It doesn't bear repeating what it was. It was dreadful. But to answer your question, like art what it came to be was painting that kind of which I turned to, because like the question that I asked myself was how do I progress forward here, because I am stuck. Like I cannot I can't return to illustration, which was the digital illustrations that I was doing. They were very textured, they were very complex on a Wacom tablet on the computer, and the fact of the matter is that I cannot do that with what's happened to me. So how do I finish my degree? Because I've got two options here. I either go home and be a full-time caregiver, which was a fate that eventually awaited me anyway after graduation, but it's what will instantly await me if I leave. Or I can finish this degree, but I need to figure out how to do that, and that only I have the answer to that, and I need to figure out how to do it. And I've been through a lot, and it's awful, but only I have the answer to that, and what do I do? And I got into such a state, and I got into a really bad place. And what was happening also at that time, during the pandemic, was my guide dog got very sick. She had benign tumors that grew. She has quite a few, but there was some that grew quite to such a size. Her harness wasn't closing anymore. She couldn't work for me. So, she couldn't really be my guide dog anymore equally. So she was gone, and I was completely on my own in my flat in Leeds. I had no friends. I had no family. I was completely detached from the world. So I got into such a dreadful place. I got into the worst place that someone could get into. I didn't want to be here anymore, because I was then just thinking, like, I was reflecting on my entire life, and, like, my life is awful. I miss my mum. I can't illustrate, you know, all of my opportunities have gone. My degree has just gone so badly. I've just gotten my grades through and they're bad. Like, I just don't know what to do. And I just didn't want to be here anymore. Like, that was the reality of it. So then I just, you know, you kind of think about things and how you'd like to not be here. Then a little voice in my head was like, let's try painting. There's some paints, they're in my drawer over there. Like, that could be a way that we could keep, you know, illustrating and finish this degree, because illustration doesn't necessarily have to be drawing, or it doesn't have to be kind of, yeah, you know, little figures and storyboards and things. Illustration is looking and seeing and interpreting the world. It can be photography, it can be moving image, it can be anything. It doesn't have to be what you were doing before. So I got my watercolors out and made an absolute mess. You know, it must have been so bad what I did. It was just like these muddy puddles. But I was there for a couple of hours, and I think at the end of it, it didn't matter what I made. It mattered how I felt.
Yeah.
And it mattered that I had fun. And that's kind of what kept me, I kept returning to it every night when I kept feeling like really stressed about my guide dog not being there. I would get the paints out and I would look forward to it, and I'd be like, this is the time for me. I would set that time aside and I would just have fun and just, you know, make that safe space to just play and explore and experiment and, you know, create gestures in the paint and listen to music too, equally kind of select music that would reflect how I feel and interpret that in gestures and movements. You know, whether that was sad songs, which usually it was. And it was, that's how I got through my summer. And then I presented all of this to my tutor in the September, and she was like, this is incredible. Like, this is so powerful. And, you know, this is definitely how I want you to proceed with your final year. And I managed to turn my degree around, and I got a first in my dissertation because I based it on art therapy and kind of like how powerful art can be as a therapy tool, and how, you know, the science of the brain and what it, not necessarily kind of painting, but kind of the creative practice, how it changes the brain, especially after complex trauma, which is what I've been through. I've been through so many traumas, and, you know, how it creates new pathways in the brain. I got through all my modules and graduated, and I'm really, really proud because I could easily have dropped out at any point. I think anybody else would have done. And just really proud to have, you know, to have done that for myself, and to have kept turning up for myself. And then, that's how I kind of got through that. And then those paintings that I made in those darkest times, I posted to my Instagram, and I kept kind of, would set that time aside too to share to me. I had like an audience of five, like there was nobody, but somewhere out there Warehouse were watching. I don't know how they found me, but Warehouse found me and got in touch with me earlier this year, like the lovely ladies of Warehouse, and that was just such a nice thing to come out of those pandemic paintings from my grief and my pain.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a powerful story, Giles, isn't it? I mean, it's
huge.
I think it's so powerful you sharing that with us. And I think, you know, I'm thinking about the paints being in that drawer. I mean, thank God they were. You know,
yeah.
Thank God those paints were in that drawer. It sounds to me like that painting and art saved you in a way.
Absolutely did.
You're talking about, you know, feeling lonely. And obviously your guide dog was having problems. And I'd imagine for anyone that doesn't have a guide dog, you know, I'm guessing they are essentially your closest companion and your best friend. And so if they're not there, I can completely understand that feeling of loneliness. And loneliness is what breeds depression. It's what breeds our toughest times, feeling isolated and cut off. And with all the traumas you've been through, I can completely understand how you'd feel so low. And I just think it's, like we said before, this idea of the things coming, things are there when you most need them, and those paint products are in your drawer, and then look at you now. I just think it's an incredible story. I think you're such an inspiration.
Thank you.
And it's so it's so powerful, and you know, it's the best example of what art can do, as you say, literally changing, you know, the way your brain works, and I think it's incredible. And I don't really have a question at the end of this. I'm quite moved by your stories. I just wanted to tell you that it moved me, I guess.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, no, likewise. I mean, and actually the thing that made me feel a little bit choked up was when you were saying you were proud of yourself. And because we don't often say that out loud, that we're proud of ourselves or our achievements. Yeah. And I'm really pleased that you said that, because you've come through so much. And actually, just to give yourself, there's a thing that Jim says on most episodes, which is like, we should give ourselves the win. And I think a lot of us are very, particularly creative people, are very bad at doing that. So I'm really pleased that you gave yourself the win, and you were able to sort of, say that you were proud of yourself, because you should be incredibly proud of yourself, because that, you know, regardless of the other things that were going on in your life, like, that's not easy to do anyway. Like, regardless, and you've been through all this stuff as well. So, yeah.
And I'm just thinking back to, like, you know, you're talking about those dickheads at college who were teasing you and being nasty. And I'm sure that was horrible. And yet you've now got so many confidence boosters that have happened to you since, in terms of your work and these people validating your work, and lovely messages from people wearing your dresses to occasions. I think that's so nice. There are good people out there, and there are nice people who want to help you and want to do well, and that's something I try to remind myself most of the time. There are good people out there, and yes, there are dickheads, but you know, there are more nice people. That's what I like. I don't know if that's true. That's what I like to tell myself.
That's the phrase from this week. Is the great phrase is there's less dickheads than there are nice people.
I agree with that. I think, definitely. I think I think the more that we could sort of open up to each other, and the more that we talk to each other, there are, you know, it is another human. And the more that we are very real with each other, there is a lot of kindness too. And I think especially this year, I've experienced a lot of kind gestures. And I've experienced the kindness of people. Equally, I've extended that kindness to others more than ever before. So I have experienced the best of people this year. We can be very nice. Equally, we can be truly awful. I think that we are nicer than we give credit to each other for. But
Now, Kimberly, you kind of touched on your technique and that, you know, how you create your artwork. Can you give us a little bit more detail about what goes into it, and what kind of what types of paints you use? And obviously, I'm always desperate to hear what kind of music you're listening to as well. So tell us a bit about your process, I guess.
Yeah, of course. So I think I'll start from when I began during the pandemic. I favoured oil pastels. Mm-hmm. I loved sort of the rough texture that it would create, because then I could then feel on the canvas or on the surface when I had used the oil and when I hadn't. And I would also scratch into it too, so I'd create like really interesting textures and techniques. It took me a while to really get the confidence to start painting and to buy a canvas. Because like I mentioned earlier, there is this sort of, there is an ivory tower, and there is a bit of elitism around painting, and you're like, oh God, am I a painter? Am I allowed into the art world? Especially if I don't have sight, am I going to get judged on this? When you start to buy a canvas, there is this kind of, how do I even broach beginning painting onto this thing? You kind of build it up into this big task, and you get very scared, or at least I did. I was just like, I don't know what to do. And was quite terrified. I gessoed it and grounded it and prepared the surface, but I was so scared to even begin to even start painting it. I just built it into this really scary thing. But once you get going, as with anything, you get into enjoying it. And for me, the colors aren't too important. Mm-hmm. And I would pick anything. I would be quite mindful not to muddy the colors though, so I would try not to to be too expressive, where I would be start merging the colors where everything starts turning brown. And I think that's always a question that I get, like, how do you know what colors you're using? And you know, you're making things where, you know, it's very expressive but it doesn't look rubbish. I'm like, well, thank you very much. I do try to not kind of, you know, doing things like a child but sort of painting on a wall. Equally, you know, I am very mindful of what I am doing, so I do try to paint with purpose. So I used to use palette knives quite a lot. You know, I am spreading the paint on. Now I am using my fingers quite a lot. I like to use my fingers. So I'm quite engaged with the surface. I have an app on my phone. It's called Swatches. So I also have Seeing AI, which will take photos and that will read the labels of my paints out, and it will also kind of pick up on what colors I'm using too. But oftentimes, that's cool. I don't really care what colors I'm using, if I'm being quite honest. It doesn't matter to me. Sometimes it does. Like, I do want to create an atmosphere. I prefer muted colors, so that I do have a muted palette from a brand called Liquitex. And as long as I'm kind of staying to the darker colors, then I'm good. Or sometimes I like to use the brighter colors for certain things. But yeah, I just like to engage with the surface, and I like to scratch in with my fingers too, just to make it more layered and engaging. And then to kind of music I listen to, everything. I think I surprise people. I guess with the way I look, I think they're expecting me to be listening to something else. But often I'm told I have the music taste of a 60-year-old bachelor. I think I have quite a surprising music taste. I like everything from, goodness. I think at the minute I'm listening to a lot of Nick Cave.
Big Nick Cave fan, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. What else am I listening to? The Amazons. I want to shout out to them because I love them very much.
Well, the Amazons are great.
Yes, they are fantastic. Yeah. I love them very much.
Jim is like beavering away on his keyboard.
Oh, yeah. Please do check them out. They're fantastic.
Yeah, the Amazons are great. Yeah, yeah.
Definitely
check them out. I am a big Morrissey fan. Which is probably quite controversial to say. I love The Doors. I'm listening to a lot of The Doors again.
You know who they are, Jim, surely.
Yeah, no, I do.
You don't need to Google them.
I'm a big Doors fan. I love The Doors, and Jim Morrison's poetry is also very good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of poetry, I've got about 3 books on my iPad of Leonard Cohen. I love his works too. Mm. And Nick Cave's book too.
Yes.
His new book. Yeah. Just all the sad stuff. Johnny Cash. All the sad men. I really got back into Kate Bush this year too, on the back of Stranger Things.
Yeah, I think everyone started.
A new appreciation for Kate Bush. Who else do I really like? It's a very hard question. It's like, who is your favourite child? It's difficult because I have such a broad.
I could answer that one easily. No, it's not. It's easy.
No, it's like, yes, I love music. Trying to think. Maybe I should turn the question around to you and then ask you what you're listening to and be like, do I like that?
I think it's always interesting for me, like when this time of year, because obviously, like, you know, I listen to Spotify generally, and when you get given your sort of top 20, you know, your top songs, and then you can go through it and you think, oh, have I really listened to that song the most?
That's true.
It's really interesting. Yeah. And then you think, and then I go through it and I'm actually looking at it now on my phone and thinking, wow, did I really listen to that the most this year? But I guess, you know, it's always really interesting to see, and actually, you know, my musical taste year on year probably doesn't change that much.
Right,
which is interesting. But yeah, it looks like a lot of Radiohead this year. Quicksand, Cave In. I'm a big fan of Cave In. Yeah, kind of a lot of alternate rock. And then, yeah, some Nick Cave's in there. So yeah,
good. Yeah.
And PJ Harvey as well. PJ Harvey.
Ooh.
Jim's looking at his now, is he?
Well, no, because I've got a 3-year-old daughter, so that obviously, if you link your Spotify to the
home,
it completely fucks up your rut at the end of the year. Yeah, exactly. I think that was in there. It was. We also live with my mother-in-law, who's in her 70s, and she uses it to listen to her music. So my top.
Oh man, yours is going to be a right mess.
Oh mate, it was something like.
If you got like Cliff Richard.
Yeah.
That would be my wife loves Cliff Richard, so that would be her influence. I think Baby Shark was in there definitely, and then there was like for some reason I listened to a lot of Green Day and the Fratellis this year for some reason, so they were up there.
Fratellis, excellent.
Yeah, so I've just got sort of back in, and then like John Fratelli's solo album, and so I just got back into them during the summer, and then it was Baby Shark, I think. Then it was like kids playtime nursery rhymes, and then it was Alan Stivell, the Irish harpist, because that's what Linda had been listening to. So a real mix that I did not want to share on my Twitter.
Oh gosh, yeah. No, certainly.
Can I ask a question about textures? Because you mentioned it there with the painting. And I think that's often something overlooked with painting, because texture is such a sort of big part of it. I went to go and see I think it was Gerhard Richter exhibition years ago, like when I was living in London, literally about a decade ago. And I was like so struck. He does these huge canvases and of like bright colours, but he did loads that are like the texture is really important, and you can see with the paint he's used, you can see the textures and what he's tried to do with it. And I went home and tried to do my own ones, and they were nowhere near as good, but it was so fun playing with texture as well as the colour. And I just think that's sort of I was struck by you talking about that, because I think that is often a part maybe overlooked when it comes to paintings.
Yeah, when you like Google works, it's probably quite compressed, the images, and they seem quite flat. And I think the interesting thing about when you go to a gallery is that you do get to experience, you can kind of witness the oils and the brush strokes. And sometimes artists will use mediums like gel mediums, or sometimes maybe like one thing I'm really enjoying at the minute is there's a medium with sand in it. So I've been mixing that into my work. Yes, it is very textured. And then there's one that I use. It's like a heavy bodied kind of medium that I've been adding to my paint, so I can create peaks. So I've been enjoying that too. And then I had a crit last week, which was really nice with my painting. So I'm doing, I didn't mention this at any point during this podcast, and I should have done. I'm doing my master's at the minute at the Royal College of Art. And I had my very first crit session with my peers, and I presented a triptych. And this is the first time I've ever done a crit with my paintings, because when I did illustration, number one, the crits that I did in my first year were illustrations, so that was fine. And then the crits that I did in my second year, I didn't turn up to them. And then in the third year, like again, I didn't really turn up to them, because you know I didn't really have to because they were kind of like paintings or whatever. But you know, this is the first time that I've presented like my actual canvas paintings to other painters, and especially at the RCA, I just felt very like, oh gosh, this is quite scary. Yeah. But one element that was really nice was, first of all, people were audio describing their work to me, so that I had an understanding of what they were presenting to us as a group before we then had a discussion and could critique the work that they were making, and could kind of have some kind of feedback to give. But equally, one of the things that we were inviting each other to do was to touch each other's work, so that I could get an idea of the scale and also sort of the materials that they've used, because some people were really, you know, quite creative and were using fabric on their canvas, which was wonderful. But then at the end, I was one of the last people to present my work, and everyone was like, can we feel yours, please? And I said, absolutely. Like, you know, having that participation to feel how I how I have involved myself into my work, because I'm quite performative, I would say. Like, I am a performance, how I respond to music, but how I'm responding to a mood or a life experience, it does become quite gestural. And I want people to kind of feel that almost like a roadmap in a way, and to understand how I've kind of I've gone across the canvas, and to kind of reenact that, almost that kind of participatory invitation. And hopefully they kind of did feel those brush strokes and those mediums, the gel mediums and the sand, but equally could also see it. But yeah, I think that is, like you say, it's an overlooked thing within the art world, is sort of the texture, and to kind of understand that a lot more, because often it is just sort of, it is just the seeing, but to kind of feel it, to feel it emotionally too. Like, it is a very powerful, you know, like, I'm reading a text at the minute for a lecture that we'll be doing on Friday, and it's called The Love of Painting. And she often talks about this overwhelming feeling of love for the medium, but also kind of the emotions that we have around painting, the love that we have for actually painting. And she describes painting and love as being like two sisters. And, like, I really loved that. I thought that was really beautiful.
It's really lovely. And I was also thinking earlier, like, how you incorporate your other senses when you're, you know, through touch and sound, obviously the music and stuff is, you know, and obviously you're, like you're saying, it's becoming performative when you're actually, you know, you're expressing yourself through your work.
Yeah.
That's really amazing, I think, and very powerful to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very engaging. Like capitalizing on all of your other senses. Yeah. Very intuitive. Yeah. It doesn't become about anything to do with your sight anymore. It's everything else. And I think that's, you know, why I do keep going back to it. I've turned it into something completely different, where I can immerse. Like, it is very immersive, and you know, it isn't about sight anymore. It's just become this, you know, other activity where it's very accessible to me. I've made it so, and that's why, you know, I love it as much as I do. And again, that's that kind of those feelings of love and admiration are attached to it. And those all those positive feelings that I didn't have with illustration at the end, that kind of felt like I was locked out of it a little bit.
And it's really, I can really hear that coming through in your voice, the way you talk about it. And it's really powerful to hear that, and amazing that you found that love and admiration. And I think everyone listening who has that thing they love as well, I think can certainly relate to that. This, you know, this, whether it's creative or not, it's something that sort of drives you, and you will have a love for it. I think that's really, really nice way to put it, this admiration for whatever it is that's your thing. But all I can think about now is I just want to go to a gallery and touch loads of paintings.
Yeah.
Because it's just another level of appreciating the art. Like, and I understand why we can't. Oils in our fingers. I get why I can't go to the Tate and just start touching everything. I get it. But I think that's a really, it's another layer to appreciating the art. And I think that's really, it's really, really fascinating. And like you said, it becomes a roadmap for the artist, and you could probably almost sort of feel the journey they made. I just think it's fantastic. And I really want to go and touch some art now, but I'm going to be banned from every gallery in London, I think.
Well, Kimberly, it's been such a joy to talk to you. Thank you so much for sharing your incredible story. And, you know, I know there's been some very challenging times, and we really appreciate you being so open about those things. And, you know, obviously we wish you all the best for the future. Your master's, when do you complete that? Are you quite early doors into that?
So first of all, thank you very much for having me. It's been wonderful to speak with you. Honestly, like, you're both so wonderful, and it just felt like I was talking to two friends. I graduate in the summer. It's just it's just a year master's.
Well, it's incredible that you're doing it, like, you know, and you know, keep being proud of yourself, because you're doing amazing stuff, and your artwork is absolutely unbelievable. It's really I'm not just saying that. I'm not blowing smoke at your ass. It is very, very good. Like, you know, it's incredible.
Well, really, I was saying to Giles, it's really, like, up my street in terms of the sort of stuff that I like. It's absolutely, and completely up my street. And I'm just really excited to see what you do next. Like, I think, you know, that's sort of the emotion I have. I'm really excited to see. Because I think you're, I mean, I actually made some notes. I don't often make notes, but I've written resilience. I think you're a really resilient person, and that's really come across in everything you've said today. And I think that's just, it's a wonderful quality. Yeah, and I'm really excited to see what you do next.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Kimberly. Take care of yourself. And
you.
Look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you very much.
Kimberly Burrows on the Blank podcast there. What an inspiring person. What an incredible story. And what a talented person. I really, really enjoyed talking to her. And I really, really came away from that feeling so inspired. And and I just love looking at her art as well. It really is the sort of art that I like. It really is sort of right up my street. And so, yeah, I just think she's fantastic. And I sort of come away, and I think we said it right at the end, I may have said it off air actually, but really excited about what's next for her.
Yeah.
You know, and what she will do next, because she's clearly so talented, and she had so many knockbacks of things, all her traumas in her life and the things that might be happening and then aren't happening. And I just feel like she is someone who is destined to only get better and better and go further and further. And she's so resilient as a person as well, which I think I said at the end there as well. So yeah, now and then these episodes come along that really are quite inspiring and almost sort of knock you for six a little bit, don't they? And I think this was one today. So yeah, fantastic person, incredibly talented, and we really, really, really thank her for opening up with her story and her journey on the pod today.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. I could echo all those words, and yeah, I think you're right. Resilience. This is a story of resilience, and it was a podcast that echoed that resilience. And the bit that really got me. Was when she said she was proud of herself, and I thought, you know, I mean, that's something we can all take away from. Sometimes be a little bit more proud of ourselves in those moments when we do well. And she should be so fucking proud of herself, because she's done amazing things. So yeah, that really got me, that bit. But really grateful for Kimberly coming on and speaking to us today. So yeah, another great episode.
Great episode, yeah. And she was sort of saying about, you know, if you find what you love, just do it, you know. And I think that's so true. And she did it, and it's, you know, it's been life changing, really. But I think that's true of everyone, really, finding your thing and you just do it, and you don't know where it will lead.
Also the power of creativity, the power of art, music, acting, you know, performance, whatever, comedy. Whatever it might be that you do, how healing that can be in those moments when it's very dark. And obviously for her, art was an escape and was something that, saved her.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think she said at one point that it literally changes the brain cells, doesn't it? When you're doing something enjoyable, and that is the power of creativity. So, yeah. I mean, not that it takes much for you and I to obviously champion creativity on this podcast, but I think if you ever needed an example, I think, you know, this week is that. So brilliant. Absolutely. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us on the pod. Really, really, really appreciate it. What an episode, Giles.
Yeah, we're so lucky, aren't we? We get to talk to these inspiring people, and like you say, it gives you time to reflect on what you're doing and, you know, how lucky you are in your particular field or you know, whatever you're doing, or even like kind of push you to be a bit more resilient about what you're doing and actually believe in yourself a bit more. I think those are real big takeaways for me today.
Definitely. It's interesting to say about reflecting. We record in the cabin, so often I have to walk. It's a 20-second walk back to my house. So often on that little walk back, I'm often reflecting on the pod and things that have come up. And I wonder if our listeners do the same. I've been intrigued to hear from our listeners whether you have moments of reflection on the pod, maybe you're out walking the dog or whatever. And how do the episodes impact your life? I'd be interested to hear that. We now and then people do tweet us when inspiration is struck, but I think this week will be a particularly inspiring one. So do let us know. Do you have moments of reflection after the pod? How do you listen to the pod in bite-sized chunks throughout the week? You know, do you find actually you listen to it a little bit throughout the week, and that helps you consume it? I mean, I'm interested.
What are those little takeaways that you have from it? Because there's so many that I have every week. There's something, you know, even if it's just one thing. Well, it's often multiple things, but it does sort of lend itself to personal growth for me and self-development. So
Hopefully, and there's always something.
Absolutely.
So if you'd like to let us know, get in contact. Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We're on there, of course, and it's all the same handle, which makes life easier. It's
what's it called? Blank Pod.
That's the one. Only 108 episodes now. At Blank Pod. So we'd love to hear from you and let us know how the pod impacts your life, I guess. Because that was an impactful episode, wasn't it?
It was.
Blimey, that was really, really inspiring. What a person. Just, incredible. Anyway, Giles, I'm going to go back trudge through the snow. And, back to my house and try and warm up. You're like, frozen.
You're in a cabin in the snow. It's like you're in like
the Hallmark movie.
The Upper Hebrides or something.
No, I'm in a Hallmark movie and I'm waiting for someone from the big city to come along and I'm going to change the way they feel about the countryside.
I want to share something with you today that I saw about Hallmark movies.
Okay.
Someone tweeted, and I thought you'd like this. It's Crystal Lowry. She's a comedian. And she's put, I watched a Hallmark movie backwards. A woman in an ugly Christmas sweater dumped her loser small-town boyfriend to pursue a law career in New York City, where she lived happily ever after in pencil skirts and amazing shoes.
I saw something similar where it was like, something similar where someone realizes they hate the countryside, moves to the big city and realizes they hate Christmas.
Like the idea of the Hallmark movies in reverse. Maybe someone should make one.
Someone's definitely got to make. Someone will. Someone's got to make. Yeah,
I've been subjected to a few this week, I have to admit, and they've all been shit.
That's the point. That's exactly how they should be. Oh man, cool. Right, I think it's time to wrap up. We'll be back next week with another episode on the Blank Podcast. Mm-hmm. But until then,
goodbye.
Stay safe, mate. I was about to say, you know, mind the snow, Giles, but you haven't got any.
Just
have a nice week.
Say mind the nice dry paths.
Mind the slightly cold air, I guess.
Yeah, it is slightly cold. Yeah, so wrap up a little bit more than normal.
Okay. Well, I'm going to wrap up massively because it's very cold here.
Yeah, good luck in the torrential snow and blizzards.
Wherever you are this week, maybe you're someone like Giles who's got nothing, or you're someone like me who's, you know,
but everything.
Six feet of snow. Wherever you are, take care. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. We'll be back next week. Have a good week, and we'll see you again soon. Bye.
Media Podcast.